Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Tonight on All In.
I also told him that no president of the United States could keep faith with the American people if they did not speak out to defend our democratic values.
Defending democracy abroad as the right wing undermines it back home. Tonight, what we know about what came out of the Biden-Putin summit and the Russian autocrats' audition for Trump TV.
People went into U.S. Congress with political demands.
Then the reporter who broke the bombshell about Trump's money man on what we're learning about Alan Weisselberg. Plus, as Juneteenth becomes a national holiday, why talking about why may be illegal in some states. And the man who led the Biden pandemic response, Andy Slavitt, on his departure from the White House, the mess they inherited, and new concerns about a pandemic that's still very active in pockets of the country. And All In starts right now. Good evening from New York. I'm Chris Hayes. The point of propaganda is to shape reality, right? The propagandist and the machinery of propaganda exists so that what is actually happening in the world can be ignored or overwritten, so that when you see before your eyes, what you see before your eyes can be waved away as an apparition. The point of journalism in a free society is to see things clearly, right? To reflect reality. And let's be clear, you know, we all bring our biases to stories. We choose which stories to tell and which stories we do not tell. Reality itself is complicated with a million stories out there, just like history itself. And so the line between good faith journalism undertaken in free society, even with a perspective or an agenda, and bad faith propaganda, that line sometimes can be obscured or faint. But believe me, it is there. What we are seeing in this country is a sustained effort of concerted propaganda to destroy the civic terrain necessary to hold up democracy. Here's what that looks like. In the wake of the January insurrection, when we all watched a marauding mob violently overtake the Capitol, having erected a gallows, shouting, hang Mike Pence, assaulting police officers left and right with the express purpose of overturning an election, doing so largely based on a false belief pumped into their heads by propagandists, the election had been stolen. The vast majority of people, I think politicians, people on the Capitol, members of the public, recoiled at what they saw that day, including most members of Congress who denounced it. Like House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who said it was the saddest day he ever had serving in Congress, and then turned around along with nearly 150 of his colleagues and voted to overturn the election, to give the mob what they wanted, in hope that it would further their aims. But at the very least, okay, at the very least, there was palpably, I think, some shared sense that what had happened was wrong, that indeed it was intolerable, an intolerable assault on democracy. And then we watched the propagandists go to work, places like Fox News and Newsmax and OAM, to override that stark and obvious reality, to rewrite it. And it does not matter, as scholars of propaganda have pointed out, that there's not much logical coherence to it. We've watched, as people have called the insurrection simultaneously, not a big deal, a sort of comical clown show. People dressed up in funny costumes, but also at the same time, it was Antifa, but also at the same time, brave patriots were met with unjustifiable force by the state. And despite the fact that none of that makes sense, despite the fact the people who stormed the Capitol had to convince their own brethren on social media they weren't Antifa, like Ryan Nichols, a Marine veteran charged in the attack who wrote on Facebook, "Hey, listen up. I hear so many reports of Antifa was storming the Capitol building. Know that every single person who believes that narrative have been duped again." Tough break. Despite all that, the point here from the propagandists was never to tell a coherent story. It was to destroy the sense of shared reality that we had. And this is, of course, the tool of propagandists everywhere. It's a tool, I should note quite clearly, the U.S. government has also used, often, quite proudly at times, U.S. propaganda. But today, we got a glimpse of it from the other side. President Joe Biden, of course, met with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Geneva. Putin is, of course, legendarily a former intelligence officer in the KGB. He runs a regime that's incredibly adept and committed to propaganda that shapes the space of the nation through propaganda. And so, in a sort of predictable and classic move, Putin talked about the January 6th insurrection in terms of oppressed dissidents.
You didn't answer my question, sir. If all of your political opponents are dead in prison, poison, doesn't that send a message that you do not want a fair political fight?
All right, about my opponents being jailed or imprisoned. People went into U.S. Congress with political demands. 400 people are now facing criminal charges. They are facing prison terms of up to 20, maybe 25 years. They are called homegrown terrorists. One of the participants, a woman, was shot dead on the spot. She was not threatening with arms or anything. Why am I bringing this up? Many people are facing the same things as we do.
See, it's all the same. Now, look, that's just Vladimir Putin doing what he does, right? He's attempting to sort of flip American sanctimony about human rights on its head. It's something he does quite adroitly. It's something that Russian leaders have done for years. And sometimes, you know, they land a few punches, right? But it's not like he's the source of the propaganda Americans are getting. That comes from right-wing media, places like Fox News. And for months now, they have been pumping people full of this story, this propaganda that the January 6th rioters were brave patriots, tread upon by the state, punished for dissent, not for a violent assault in the Capitol to overturn an election. And this narrative has now ended up in the final resting place of all conspiracy theories, the false flag theory. Last night, Fox News host Tucker Carlson was selling his audience in his, you know, just asking questions way that the entire thing, the storming the Capitol by a mob of rioters, was a false flag set up by the FBI. This conspiracy theory, the feds are behind the Capitol riot, is based on a report from this fringe right-wing publication Revolver, which we know Donald Trump likes. It's crazy, crazy stuff. It's in the same category as Hugo Chavez's ghost changing votes and Italians using magical satellites to get into voting machines. But again, the purpose here is not for communicating information. It is to break the consensus of reality so that people can be manipulated and radicalized. And it is incredibly dangerous, and it is working. A new poll out today says that more than half of Republican voters think election reviews will change the 2020 outcome. They won't. There's nothing to review. FBI is now warning lawmakers that QAnon followers may become more violent. And a new survey from the Brennan Center says that 1 in 3 U.S. election officials feels unsafe on the job. 1 in 6 reported being threatened because of their work. 1 in 6. The same people, like Kevin McCarthy, whose adrenaline was rushing through their cheeks, right, in the wake of that fight-or-flight response, with the crowd outside, when they huddled into secret locations away from the mob that was braying for their blood, who could recognize the danger of what they saw in that moment. All those same folks, right, who are on the other side of the door, up to and including Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, are now running cover for this propaganda. Ruth Ben-Ghiat is a professor of history at New York University. Her latest book is titled Strong Men, From Mussolini to the Present. And Mehdi Hasan is the host of The Mehdi Hasan Show, which you can find on MSNBC and streaming on Peacock. And they join me now. Professor, let me start with you about the kind of tools of propaganda here and the kind of resonances. And I want to be very clear. It's not like the right-wing propaganda about January 6th like originated as Russian disinformation. It's just a kind of happy coincidence that they found each other as an answer here. But the sort of way that we're watching propaganda shape the sense of reality among, you know, half our fellow citizens or a little less than half of them. Professor, are you there?
Yes.
What effect does it have?
I'm really concerned because I see this convergence between, some of the through lines that we're being told are the same as the right-wing authoritarian playbook for 100 years. And it's where the GOP and Russian propaganda and the far right are converging. And one of them is that liberal democracy is a failed system. It brings chaos and anarchy. And so you're trying to build an appetite for authoritarian rule. And another is that liberal democracy is tyranny. And so we hear a lot of talk about Biden being a dictator, wanting to impose a socialist or Marxist dictatorship. And he's going to take our guns away. He's going to make us wear masks. And he's going to force feed critical race theory. And so there you have the GOP, which poses, and this is where January 6th becomes an act of patriotism. They pose as the defenders of freedom. And I'm also worried about connections with, you know, the military. There's, I like a retired military issued a letter where they said our constitutional rights are threatened, our nation's in peril. It's like coup talk. And some of it reminds me of what I used to see before I read about in Chile before the coup there. So this is all very concerning. And so propaganda connects with violence always. And so it justifies violence. And the big point is that the GOP has become a far-right party, which uses disinformation and violence and renders them acceptable as ways of doing politics. This is the bottom line.
You know, Mehdi, you and I imagine have sort of been through parts of the long, broad coalition spectrum of the center left in the U.S. and the U.K. And one thing I've learned over the years doing that is, like, when people start talking false flags, my radar goes up and I get very skeptical. Right. And, I mean, you know, there have been in history actual false flags. It's not like insane that. But whenever someone's like, that's a false flag, it's like, okay, well, we have a very high bar for evidence here. That's like Alex Jones stuff. 9/11 was an inside job. You know, you've got here now, we're arriving at the false flag point of the January 6th conspiracizing.
We are indeed. It gets more and more radical by the day. If you remember, Chris, the Oregon GOP actually put out a statement claiming it was a false flag, comparing it to the Reichstag fire a few weeks ago, and then they kind of went silent. Hawaii GOP said some QAnon nonsense. Some of these state parties have said similar things. But yes, Tucker Carlson says it on primetime cable. That's a big difference. And whatever Tucker Carlson says tends to go mainstream on the right very quickly. It's only a matter of time till we hear other members of Congress say this stuff. You mentioned inside jobs and 9/11. Well, it's appropriate that Marjorie Taylor Greene is now the biggest fundraiser on the House GOP side because she's a 9/11 truther anyways. Right. So it's good for her. It's a very short journey for her to become a January 6th truther, which I'm sure we'll see very soon. But look, the overlap here is clear between Tucker Carlson, between Republican House members, between Vladimir Putin. When I saw Putin speak today about January 6th, I thought, wow, the president of Russia is doing his best impression of Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, right? Because that is the kind of nonsense we have heard from sitting senators. The overlap is there. And this stuff works. Chris, you make the point about propaganda. The point of propaganda is not to convince the other side. It's not to change anyone's minds. It's to give your own side a feeling of goodness that the bonkers things you believe, they're all true. And so today you have one in four Republicans saying, you know, a cabal of pedophiles runs America. One in four Republicans says we may have to use violence to save the Republican. One in three Republicans says Donald Trump will be back as president in August.
Right.
Where do they get this stuff from? It's from the propaganda machinery, whether it's on Fox, whether it's from the Russian government, whether it's from Republicans in Congress. It is deeply worrying. Ruth is not being hyperbolic to talk about coup talk. If we saw this in any other country, a defeated president refusing to accept the result, talking about coming back in a few months' time, his party controlling the majority of state governments, what would we call that?
Right. And that the point there, I think that's important here, that Ruth, that you're making before, is that there's a distinction between, like, look, political messaging is always going to be a kind of sales job. It's always going to be spin. It's always going to tell a half truth. It's always going to, like, try to use rhetoric, right, in a wedge way. It's the specificity of the idea of liberal democracy itself as decadent. Democracy, like this kind of frontal assault on the system itself and its integrity that I find so worrying, that we're seeing sort of trotted out and workshopped in real time around January 6th.
That's it. And January 6th was a intensely radicalizing event for the GOP. And it's why, of course, it was prepared by 4 years of Trump applying the authoritarian playbook. But it's why it wasn't a moment where they said, oh, we've gone too far. We're the law and order party. We're pro-police. And yet we, you know, injured 140 Capitol Police. Instead, they're like intoxicated with the possibilities of lawlessness. And so they've doubled down and become even more radical. And this is highly concerning. And in terms of what they're doing, they're kind of throwing everything at the wall where, you know, January 6th, there was no violence. And Trump said there's hugs and kisses. And now there's also violence, but it's Antifa. Right. And now it's the FBI. And this is a difference between propaganda today and 100 years ago, where it used to be like Mussolini is always right. And you still have that where people say whatever Trump says is true. But the point is also, and this is the Russian model called the fire hose of falsehood. You just throw so much stuff at the zone of truth that nobody knows what's going on anymore. You don't know what to believe. And then you give up, and it's easier to just right. accept what, you know, Mr. Strongman tells you.
Yeah. Yes, that the sort of defeat of the faculties as the point here, Maddie.
Yes.
Oh, I mean, Ruth mentions the fire hose of the lies. I mean, Steve Bannon said it famously in an interview when he said, our enemy is not the Democratic Party. Our enemy is the media. And the way you deal with the media is to flood the zone with excrement, was the phrase he used. Right. And that is what they have done so successfully. Trump does it naturally. It comes to him naturally. And the rest of the Republicans do it in a completely cynical way. Chris, think about how cynical and dishonest this January 6th narrative is. Because they start off by saying, well, it was Antifa. It was the left. Matt Gaetz said it on the very night, I remember. Then they say, well, actually, okay, maybe it was our people, but they were rowdy patriots, to quote Ron Johnson. They were tourists, to quote Andrew Clyde. And now they say, well, okay, it was the FBI. It was an inside job. Let's say you believe any of that nonsense. Here's a question. Don't you want to have it investigated? The same people vote against an independent commission to investigate the very attack that they seem to come up with a new theory for every day. If you really believe it was the FBI, wouldn't you want to investigate that with a bipartisan independent commission?
And the final point on this, right, is that they voted against that bipartisan commission knowing the House could impanel a special committee because they didn't want... It was more of a threat to have a bipartisan commission that could create a shared sense of yes. consensus reality than That's something right. they could dismiss as essentially a partisan hatchet job. Ruth Ben-Ghat and Mehdi Hasan, thank you very much. Next, everything we know about what happened to the Biden-Putin summit today with a man who has been in that room before and...
Everybody lies for Donald. And it's okay to lie yeah. so long as that there's no documentary evidence in order to back up the opposite. And my point to you and to your listeners and to your viewers is that that information is already in the hands of those people that are seeking the cooperation of Alan Weisselberg.
New York Times reporter who broke the story about possible charges for Trump exec Alan Weisselberg joins me ahead.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has been in power, either sort of in president or behind the scenes of the president, nearly 22 years since 1999. He's the longest serving Russian leader since Joseph Stalin, who ran the Soviet Union for nearly 30 years. And since he came to power, Putin has presented a continuous problem for the United States, administration after administration. Still, each American president tries to start afresh, as we saw with George W. Bush in 2001, when he famously looked into Putin's soul.
I looked the man in the eye. I found it to be very straightforward and trustworthy. We had a very good dialogue. I was able to get a sense of his soul.
8 years later, under the new Obama administration, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton infamously presented Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov with a reset button. Only the word on the button did not actually mean reset in Russian. Due to a translation error, the button instead had the Russian word for overcharged. Whoops. When Donald Trump became president, well, it was a little different. I mean, we already knew from our intelligence agencies that Russia sabotaged the 2016 election with the goal of harming Hillary Clinton's presidential bid and helping to get Trump elected. So, of course, Trump defended Putin from the beginning.
My people came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be.
Right. Why would they interfere to make me president unless they, well, Biden, not surprisingly, has a pretty different view. Back in 2001, days after President Bush declared Biden was trustworthy, then Senator Biden said, quote, I don't trust Putin. Today, President Biden met with Putin for the first time as president. The two men met for just under 4 hours. They discussed a long list of critical issues, including human rights, cyber attacks, and election sabotage. And though President Biden struck a note of optimism, saying he thinks there's a genuine prospect to significantly improve the relations between our two countries, he remained realistic about who we were dealing with.
And now that you've talked to him, do you believe you can trust him?
Look, this is not about trust. This is about self-interest and verification of self-interest. That's what it's about. So I almost anyone that I would work out an agreement with that affected the American people's interest, I don't say, well, I trust you, no problem. Let's see what happens. You know, as that old expression goes, the proof of the pudding's in the eating. We're going to know shortly.
Axios politics editor Glenn Johnson was in several meetings with Vladimir Putin as a senior aide to former Secretary of State John Kerry. He writes about those experiences in his book, Window Seat on the World, and he joins me now. Glenn, maybe you could talk a little bit about what the objective of this kind of meeting is and what, you know, you've got this short amount of time, you've got these two leaders, you've got a very fraught relationship, you've got huge amounts of staff work, right, that go into it. Then they got to go in there and execute whatever. Like, what are you trying to do in a meeting like this?
I think what President Biden was trying to do and what he admitted to trying to do afterwards during his news conference was basically go in there and lay down a marker. He wanted Vladimir Putin to hear from directly from him how he felt about certain things, whether it's cyber attacks, whether it's the treatment of Alexei Navalny or others. He wanted to hear straight from the horse's mouth his opinion about that so that he could be on the record with him face to face, no intermediaries, no lost translation between Tony Blinken and Sergey Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, directly leader to leader where he stood, because he felt like there were some things that were spiraling out of control. And I very much feel like today's meeting was him laying down a marker. Here is where we are. Here is what we're going to try and work on together. And if we can't get there, here are the consequences. And he's willing to let Putin see if he wants to engage under those terms.
Yeah, it was interesting to me that the rhetoric was very shorn of some of the kind of like high flown, you know, condemnations, or it was a very kind of almost game theoretical thing he's trying to set up, right? Like, we're two players in this game who are going to have some kind of exchanges here. Let's try to get them in some reciprocal footing where we both know what the other will do. I mean, that was a huge part, obviously, of the development of nuclear diplomacy over the decades in which we could have annihilated all humans on Earth if we made a mistake in that relationship. And it felt like sort of hearkening back to that a little bit on some of this stuff, cyber attacks and other things.
What was interesting, too, was even Vladimir Putin said afterward during his news conference that he felt President Biden was an experienced interlocutor with him. And you saw it in myriad ways. I wrote last night for Axios about how the Russian leader famously used to keep Secretary of State Kerry and others waiting, try and throw them off their game, try and, you know, have them all ready to jump on the field and then ice them on the sidelines. The Americans insisted this time that he show up first. And so, in fact, Putin landed and arrived right on time. So they took that issue off the table. Then you go into the room, and the Russians are very famous for airing grievances and all this whataboutism, where they try and undercut anything you're saying to them by bringing up what they consider to be parallel examples in the United States. They're very well studied on U.S. history, and they're really ready to throw it back in your face. Biden team was all onto that. And I thought was also very interesting was President Biden brought in when they expanded to the larger five-person group. He brought in Toria Nuland, who used to be the former State Department spokesperson, now is the Undersecretary for Political Affairs, a Russian speaker who President Putin literally hates. And he brought her in there because he wanted to show that he had experienced personnel around him, and they were basically onto all the sort of semantics and acts. Now can we engage substantively on major issues between the two countries?
Yeah, I mean, Nuland infamously laid flowers right at the Maidan in Kiev, right, with the site of the color revolution against the Putin crony who'd been kicked out. You have a U.S. diplomat doing that. Obviously, she knew what she was doing. I thought this point about the new Cold War was very interesting, too, because there's been a Russian talking point for a long time about the need to avoid a new Cold War. And it was interesting to hear Biden basically come out and say that, which, again, I agree with substantively. Take a listen.
I said to him, I said, your generation and mine are about 10 years apart. This is not a kumbaya moment, as he used to say back in the 60s in the United States, like, let's hug and love each other. But it's clearly not in anybody's interest, your country's or mine, for us to be in a situation where we're in a new Cold War. And I truly believe he thinks that. He understands that. But that does not mean he's ready to, quote, figuratively speaking, lay down his arms and say, come on.
I thought that was pretty well said. Like, the point here is to get us into a place where we understand each other enough that we're not engaging in things that spiral out of control, essentially.
Right. I mean, a Cold War in this day and age between the U.S. and Russia is really asymmetric. You'll notice that both leaders referred several times to their nuclear stockpiles, right? But short of exchanging them, that's largely off the table. The areas of engagement right now are economic, where the U.S. has a huge lead and why Russia is so ready to try and team up with China in some way. And then also this cyber weapon that the Russians appear to have been so ready to use. That is a real game changer for them and a real power for them relative to the United States, a way to equate themselves. And that was something that the president went right after. I mean, he handed him a list of 16 critical infrastructure sites in the U.S. and said, don't hit these.
Yes.
I mean, talk about a roadmap. And that, and in fact, created this marker for the president. Yep. If those things get hit, you know, he's going to have to try and do something about it. So President Biden really leaned into this with him.
Glenn Johnson, that was really insightful. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris.
Ahead, Alan Weisselberg, the guy who could single-handedly sink Donald Trump, the man who holds all the receipts, could face charges this summer. Will he flip on the former president to save himself? That's next. Alan Weisselberg has been around the Trump family for a very, very long time. In fact, he was first hired by Trump's father, Fred, more than 40 years ago. He's been the chief financial officer of the Trump Organization for over 20 years. In November 2019, ProPublica first reported that Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance was investigating Weisselberg for falsification of business records related to a hush money payment to Stormy Daniels. Since then, there's been a kind of drip, drip, drip of reports of increasing pressure on Weisselberg to flip on Donald Trump. In March, the New York Times reported prosecutors were asking questions about Weisselberg's grown children. In May, the Wall Street Journal reported prosecutors had subpoenaed a school attended by Weisselberg's grandchildren, possibly examining whether the Weisselbergs evaded taxes with the tuition payment arrangement. 2 weeks ago, ABC News reporting that Weisselberg's top lieutenant, Jeff McConney, had already testified before a special grand jury impaneled by the Manhattan DA, culminating in last night's bombshell from New York Times that reported prosecutors has obtained Weisselberg's personal tax returns and, quote, he could face charges this summer. For a long time, it was unclear where, if anywhere, the Weisselberg investigation was headed. Were they really going to try to nab him for his grandchildren's school payments? It's hard to imagine anyone going to jail for that kind of thing unless there's systematic malfeasance. But this latest New York Times report indicates a Manhattan district attorney might just have enough to indict him. William Rauschbaum is a senior writer on the Metro staff in New York Times covering corruption who helped break the news of Weisselberg's looming legal danger. And he joins me now. Great reporting, William. Can you give us a sense of where we are in this process as best you can determine from your reporting?
Well, thanks for having me on, Chris. There are a lot of indicators that suggest that the DA's office is in the final stages of a criminal tax investigation of Mr. Weisselberg. They've subpoenaed his tax returns, as you pointed out. They've subpoenaed his bank records. They've subpoenaed records relating to leased cars that he's been provided by the Trump Organization. They've looked at an apartment that he's been provided with by the Trump Organization for some time. They're looking to pressure him to cooperate with their investigation. And if he doesn't, they would lose a fair amount of credibility if they did not bring charges against him.
You just ticked off a number of things, and they kind of line up with some of the reporting we've gotten, which is to indicate the following. And obviously, this is a man who has not been charged of anything as of yet, and is, were he to be charged, is innocent until proven guilty. We have no comment from him. But point being that there are various areas that they're looking into. It does seem to me like a fair amount has been brought to bear in investigative sense of a wide array of the man's activities, that there may be exposure for him vis-a-vis criminal tax liability.
The question is sort of, we, you know, grand juries operate in secret, and we have a relatively limited view into that. Exactly what his criminal exposure is hard to gauge from where we sit, but clearly the calculus for him is whether he feels that he is going to have a problem, and whether or not they're going to try and put him in prison. So it's a personal decision to cooperate. There's a lot of factors. Different people respond in different ways. It's a very complicated and difficult position that he finds himself in. We'll see where he goes with it.
Where does cooperation or talks of cooperation or even deals cooperation usually come in the order of operations here? We've seen recently, for instance, with in Florida with Joel Greenberg, right, who is the public official a tax commissioner, right, who had been charged. He had a bunch of charges. The charge came first, and then those charges were reduced down to one charge in a plea deal, in which he then agreed to cooperate, apparently. I mean, generally, do charges come before cooperation?
It can go either way. In general, if the charges are being brought, it's because the person who's the focus has chosen not to sort of cooperate with the government. And as a result of that, the charges are brought. Sometimes after that, someone will cooperate. Often they have made the calculation that they're going to fight it, and they're going to go to trial and fight it in court. But it could go either way.
Did your reporting indicate anything about what Weisselberg's relationship is with Trump or the organization at this point? I guess that's sort of a black box.
Mr. Weisselberg has worked for Trump for a long time. He has been sort of a very loyal member of the Trump Organization. He's serves in a high position. He's the chief financial officer. He's involved in a lot of the sensitive internal workings of the Trump Organization. He was a key player, according to Michael Cohen and others, and court papers that have been filed. Was a key player in how Mr. Cohen was reimbursed for the right. Hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. So that puts him in. Clearly, he's someone who was in a position of trust and in the inner circle, for lack of a better term.
All right. William Rauschbaum, who's been doing that reporting for The Times, thank you so much for making time.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. Coming up, over a quarter of the states in the union have hit the president's 70% vaccination milestone. But will the rest of the country catch up by the 4th of July goal? The man who led the White House COVID response, Andy Slavitt, joins me. Don't go anywhere. June 19th, 1865 was the day that Union Army Major General Gordon Granger issued a general order, officially and finally liberating the enslaved black people of Texas, which was the most remote part of the Confederacy, who had still been kept under the whip months after Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox. In other words, it is the day of full national liberation and has been celebrated as such by African Americans for years. Now, there has been no national official holiday to mark this moment, but it looks like that's about to change. Earlier this evening, to loud applause, the House approved a bill to make Juneteenth a national holiday.
On this vote, the yeas are 415 and the nays are 14. The bill is passed.
The bill will now go to President Joe Biden's desk to be signed into law. And while 14 House Republicans voted against the bill tonight, yesterday the Senate adopted it unanimously. Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin had spent much of the last year objecting to it, he said, on cost grounds, but he finally backed down. And if you were surprised that all Republican senators who are simultaneously whipping up a moral panic about race and education would endorse such a holiday, listen very closely to how John Cornyn of Texas explained his reasoning earlier today.
I think everybody saw this as something that would be an important symbolic gesture and a way to reach out to people of different races and to say, I know that Juneteenth has been celebrated within the African-American community around the country in Texas and elsewhere. But frankly, this is something I think all Americans can celebrate. And hopefully this will promote greater understanding into the history.
Senator Cornyn, who represents Texas, where Governor Greg Abbott just signed a law today making it harder to teach about the history of white supremacy and racial hierarchy in America, endorses this vote on Juneteenth because he says it is a symbolic gesture. What a tell, what a word to use as justification. This is the game. Here, have your holiday while we attack your right to vote and stop schools from teaching you what Juneteenth is even about or how it came about. It's pretty astoundingly cynical. But another way to see this is as a kind of success for the very forces that Greg Abbott and John Cornyn and so many others say they fear. At some point in time, the simple act of celebrating Juneteenth itself was seen as radical or weird or outside the mainstream of the sanitized story that white historians told about the war and its causes and aftermaths, about the nobility of the Confederacy and the men who fought and killed to preserve the most evil institutions. That version of history lost, at least in this battle, for this holiday, celebrating emancipation. The optimistic way to view this contradiction between the attack on education and voting, while also endorsing the holiday, is that when they say they are losing their country, or their vision of it, they are right in a certain way. They are losing. The anti-critical race theory hysteria, the desperate attempts to reduce democratic participation, are the activities of a coalition losing the battle of ideas. Let's hope they keep losing.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
A fireworks display lit up New York Harbor last night in honor of essential workers and in celebration of New York State lifting restrictions after reaching a milestone, 70% vaccination rate among adults. Limitations on businesses and social gatherings are now all virtually gone, although individual businesses do still have the option of requiring precautions like masks or social distancing. New York was the 14th state in the country to hit that 70% goal. That's 70% of adults having at least their first shot set by President Biden last month. The White House still hopes to see 70% of all American adults receive at least one dose by July 4th. California also celebrated lifting restrictions yesterday. Governor Gavin Newsom declaring Tuesday reopening day, with 72% of adults in that state having received at least one dose of the vaccine. So, obviously, big cause for celebration, California and New York, and the 15 other states that have reached 70%. Not going the same way everywhere. I mean, several states, especially in the South, have yet to clear even 50%. And case counts are rising in those areas where less people are vaccinated. Andy Slavitz, the former senior advisor for the Biden administration's COVID-19 response, author of the new book, Preventable, the inside story of how leadership failures, politics, and selfishness doomed the U.S. coronavirus response. Andy, great to have you in the program. You know, one of the things that I think you and a lot of people around the Biden administration said from the outset, even during the transition, was we need a national response. You can't outsource it to the states. It can't be this kind of distributed response. Obviously, states are going to do a lot. And I think you guys have done a very good job of that, the Biden administration. But when you look at the top five, bottom five in states right now in vaccinations, there's a big spread. And it's kind of what you would think, right? You got Vermont, Hawaii, Massachusetts, and Connecticut, New Jersey, very high levels of vaccination. Tennessee, Wyoming, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, very low levels. What does that say? And how do you close that gap?
Well, Chris, you know, I think one of the president's goals is to try to unify the country. And those differences are stark, and those differences, more importantly, are dangerous. Because if the Delta variant or some other variant is kicking into gear come fall, if you're living in a state without a high vaccination level, or you yourself are not highly vaccinated, that can cause for trouble. So if you've been vaccinated, you live in a place where most of the people around you are likely vaccinated as well, you have very little to fear from these variants.
But I mean, the question becomes, right? I mean, I know there's money that's going out, there's targeting happening. What's the timeline for? I mean, I guess the question is, can you get those states to 70%? Right? It's just going to take a little longer, or are we just going to live in these kind of two Americas, right? In terms of the level of community transmission and herd immunity.
Well, you may know that in past pandemics and epidemics, the South, we've seen disease linger in the Southeast for sometimes as long as two decades. And so this is not a new phenomenon. Mm. So it is something that we hope to avoid. We hope to avoid by educating people, allowing people to do their homework, get their questions answered, allow them to talk and listen to people locally. And, you know, I think the good news is I do think you're right. It's going to require some patience. But with that patience, we don't have 30 to 40% of the country that's anti-vaccine. We have a very, very small part of the country that's anti-vaccine. So what's more likely going on is we've got a lot of people to whom they're not sure about this particular vaccine. And it may be a more considered decision. They may wait for the FDA to do full approval. Hmm. They may want a year to go by. But my sense is we'll be at or very close to 60 to 70% nationally by the 4th of July, with big diversions. And then over time, we're going to have to keep working it, and it's going to be more patient and more plotting than we think. But I think this will become the norm eventually.
This WAPO Washington Post headline I thought was great. It says coronavirus infections dropping where people are vaccinated, rising where they are not, post analysis finds. And if you look at the new reported cases in the U.S., you know, you see this remarkable decline, right? I mean, the huge winter peak and then that remarkable decline. And now we're at a kind of a little bit of a plateau that seems like where we're going to be at. And of course, the transmissibility of the Delta variant is the big variable here.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the other way to look at this is 98.9 or 99% of the people who are in hospitals with COVID-19 or who die from COVID-19 have one thing in common. They haven't been vaccinated.
Right.
So it is indeed a very simple equation, but people don't necessarily feel that risk personally right now, particularly as we sit here today. So, you know, these variants will be out there. The COVID will, this is supercharged COVID, as you said. It's more easier to catch, it's easier to pass. And our hope is that people will go, if they're not vaccinated, they'll go talk to their doctor or someone else they trust locally they won't go to Facebook and buy on some rumor, and that will cause them to want to get vaccinated.
Does the administration have concrete targets for shipping vaccine doses and getting them in the hands of folks? I know that we've started to see them scale up in their pledges. You know, it was 80 million and now it's, they're talking about 500 million maybe doses by a certain point. Are there concrete targets in the White House for shipping those doses by certain dates?
Yeah, so I think you'll see about half of, so first of all, just to recap your announcement, very exciting announcement before the G7 last week that we are going to take the lead by buying 500 million doses and donating them to low and mid income countries using a global system that puts the U.S. as a great example. And I think it caused other countries to match that. We still need billions more vaccines. Unfortunately, these vaccines take time to make. I think about half of those vaccines will be out and into arms this year and the other half by the middle of next year. But just as we did in the U.S., where we cut in half the time it took to accelerate manufacturing and distribution, we're going to be working on the same thing overseas. And eventually, we are going to be the arsenal for the world manufacturing vaccines. And I think it's going to be a good story. But it can't happen quickly enough because we have an inequality problem and a variant all that's striking us across the world.
Do people in the White House view this still, you think, as their number one job?
I think so. I think the president has talks about four things more than anything else. The ending the pandemic, which is the key to everything else, the economic recovery, racial justice, and the climate. And in those areas, I think the president is going to have a distinctive record, a record that breaks from kind of where we've been in the past. I think he is patient and clear and in his understanding, as is Ron Klain, the chief of staff, that everything links through being able to have this pandemic defeated. And these are not people that declare victory early.
Yeah.
And I'm very confident that the people there are going to continue the path that we're on.
Andy Slava, thank you so much. Thank you for joining me on my podcast this week. Why Is This Happening? Our newest episode is available wherever you get your podcasts. That does it for All In. You can catch us every weeknight at 8 o'clock on MSNBC. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/allinwithchris.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.